have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and today we're going to talk with you about controlling invasive species. We often say it's a never-ending battle, and today we're going to be talking about some new efforts in the war against those invasives. Kelly Kern's back with us. She's the invasive plant coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR. Kelly, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
With me and with us in the studio as well, Ann Pierce, UW Extension Invasive Species Outreach Specialist, Program Coordinator for the Wisconsin First Detector Network. Ann, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Great to have you with us. We're talking about how you, as you listen in, can help by reporting what you're seeing, among other things. Have you been involved in fighting invasives? Certainly get a lot of calls and emails about invasives, and you may have some firsthand experience. And if you have a question about them, I hope you'll join in. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can go ahead and post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And Kelly, when you were here last year, June was Invasive Species Awareness Month, and this year it's changed to Invasive Species Action Month. Why that change?
Well, we decided that we have been doing Awareness Month for many years now, and people are pretty aware about invasive species, as we can tell from the listeners of the show, that a lot of people are pretty familiar with a lot of these species. And we really want to move people from awareness to action and getting them to report the new species coming in or to take action on their own property and start controlling things and working with others in their region and trying to get some control at that level as well.
Yeah. And as we look at the species, what are the big ones that we're working on?
Well, right now we have some things that are just starting to bloom. Wild parsnip will be blooming here pretty soon. People are going to be seeing that all over the roadside, those tall yellow umbrella-shaped flowers. And that's the one to watch out for because it can give you a burn if you get too close and get that sap on your skin. And another relatively new one in most of the state that is in bloom right now as well is wild chervil. And we have a couple of real hot spots for wild chervil in the state where it's spreading mostly on roadsides and then into adjacent fields and even woodland edges. And it's a white umbrella-shaped flower like that as well. Not quite as tall as a parsnip, but really dense where it's at. All over the roadside, very ferny type leaf.
And where are we seeing those?
Chippewa and Dunn counties have really big infestations. Columbia has one. I just heard about a new infestation in on the west side of Madison, and we have a couple in the southeast. So there's a number of places. It is popping up, and it spreads really easily on mowing equipment.
Mm.
And then there's another one that looks really similar to it called poison hemlock that is pretty similar looking, but it's a little bit more robust, a bit of a more stouter plant with more firm kind of umbel flowers on the top. And that one is mostly in Iowa County, but popping up in a few other places as well. And that one is really poisonous to eat. So if that gets into pastures or into hay fields, that can be really bad for the farmers.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Ann, let me turn to you for a minute. You're program coordinator for the Wisconsin First Detector Network. Tell us about that program. What's that all about?
Sure. The Wisconsin First Detector Network was started 5 years ago, and we are the statewide citizen science network for monitoring invasive species. And in addition to training people how to identify and report invasive species, we also provide workshops and a lot of online educational resources.
And so is that statewide then, or how's it going? Are you expanding to statewide?
We've been statewide the entire time. So we have folks from all over the state that are submitting invasive species reports to us and volunteering in invasive species efforts.
So what's the information you're looking for from them?
We take any invasive species reports from anybody across the state. And so while we definitely focus on some of the priority species like the ones that Kelly just mentioned, some of our efforts also include doing research on these invasive plant infestations, and Nels will address that later. But because of those research efforts, we are happy to take any reports.
And how do people find out about how they can help?
They can visit our website, which is fyi.uwex.edu/WIFDN.
Oh, and my goodness.
It's a long
one. Is there
one.
A shorter one version of that? That
Unfortunately
we...
not.
So do it again for me.
It's fyi.uwex.edu/WIFDN.
Maybe we can get that up on our Facebook page. Jill says, well, maybe we can. We'll give that a shot anyway. Well, already some callers online. By the way, you can join in with your own question or comment at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And, well, let's go to John in Eau Claire. John, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, we live about 3 miles south of Eau Claire in a development of about 25 homes. Each yard is about 2 acres. And probably about 7 years ago, my brother-in-law was over one time, and he said, your northern property line, it's just full of buckthorn. And I didn't really know much about buckthorn, but we have a lot of really beautiful bur oaks that the buckthorn was getting so tall you could hardly see the trunk of the oaks at all. So I started every fall and every spring, I take a day or two and I try to get 4 loads, cut trailer loads that I haul out to the brush site. And I've noticed that, I did hear that when they drop their berries in the fall, that they kind of give off some kind of an acidic mixture that prevents anything else from growing. But I've noticed as I've cut them out and try to keep the new growth under control with spray, a selective spray, that I'm seeing all kinds of beautiful ferns and wildflowers coming in, and kind of the underlying canopy is really, really cool. And we cut out a big chunk in the front up by the road. I know the neighbor wasn't happy about that because it provided to his property, but we replaced it with service berry and royal star magnolias, and I think as they mature, that's going to be really, really beautiful. But if you have any comments or thoughts about controlling buckthorn, I'm all ears to hear what you got to say.
John, sounds like you're doing a pretty good job. Kelly, what about it?
Yeah, I think it's great. He sounds like he's definitely doing a good job of restoring. Just keep an eye on it. Those things, the seeds will keep germinating over the next many years, and you will keep getting resprouts from some of those plants that you've cut down. But it sounds like you're doing the right thing. Most people, when they cut a buckthorn, the thing to do is to either do a basal bark application where you actually apply a concentrated herbicide around the base before you cut it and let it die first before you cut it, or you cut it and then do a cut stump application. And it sounds like John's probably doing one of those.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, good going, John. Anything else for him? I just keep it up, I suppose.
Keep it up, yeah. You're exactly what we want to hear, people doing that.
Well, I certainly wasn't surprised to hear a question about buckthorn. Man, we may get some other questions about buckthorn as the show moves along, but let's go to Julie in Wales, Wisconsin. Julie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. How are you guys doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Well, I have a problem with garlic mustard weed, and I cannot contain it. Every single year I go pull it, and then there's more and more blooms, and it just seems, I have 2 acres, and it seems to have taken over my property, and I just don't know. I'm at my wit's end, and I don't know what to do. Help!
Well, first, what is, some people may wonder, what does it look like?
Sure. So garlic mustard already bloomed much earlier this year. It's already going into seed now. And it has, it overwinters as a basal rosette of leaves that are somewhat rounded with scalloped edges. And then it sends up a flowering stalk with 4-petaled white flowers, small flowers, and smells like garlic if you crush it. So it's pretty easy to identify. And when you have a really large patch, like 2 acres, that is a lot to hand pull. And most people that try to do that get burned out because they can't be successful trying to hand pull 2 acres. So either you can give up, which a lot of people do, or you can try to use an herbicide. And ideally doing that really early in the season before any of the wildflowers come up, but when the garlic mustard is green and growing. And then again in the fall after everything else has died back, but again, the garlic mustard is green and growing on one of those nice warm days in the fall after we've had a frost, and doing that repeatedly for probably at least 10 years. And
10 years.
At least. Yeah, we know the seeds can continue germinating well past 10 years. Most of them will already have germinated the first few years, but you will still have, you know, stragglers that come along after a number of years.
And you want to beat those down, those stragglers.
Yeah. Well,
otherwise,
you don't
they're going to come right back.
Yeah, you don't want to let anything go to seed. It only reproduces by seed, so as long as you don't let it go to seed, then you're cutting short the time that it can survive.
Julie, how old are you?
I'm 47. I'm worried about my neighbors not doing their part. So I'll clean up my lot, and next thing you know, it's all back. So I think I have a task at hand.
I think you've got a neighbor task at hand probably, too.
Yeah, there is some good news on garlic mustard. We have had some work on a biological control and some insects that have been that keep it in check in Europe where it's from, and we've had research going on since the late 90s on that, and we've had initial approval for one of the insects to be released here, which means it's probably going to be a couple of years before it is, and before it's available for people at the earliest. But there's also something going on where some patches of garlic mustard seem to be dying back and on their own, and we're not really sure what it is. We think it might be a reaction to the chemicals that the garlic mustard puts in the soil that kills off other species, that they're not doing that as much. So there's research going on to find out what's happening. But a few people are starting to see that in Wisconsin and even more so in New England, where it's been a problem longer.
You know, people, I can get a little nervous about, okay, here we are introducing another insect into our environment, but we've had some good luck. I'm thinking, maybe purple loosestrife?
Right, yeah, and the process that's used for researching biological control is very detailed right now. That's why it's been since the late 1990s. It's been over 20 years that they've been doing the research on these insects and testing it against every related plant and even things that aren't related, like corn. This has no relation whatsoever to garlic mustard. But they test on a lot of these things to see if it could cause any problems.
Yeah. So good luck, Julie. I'm glad that you're only 47 because you might be still fighting it when you hit retirement. I hope not. Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Well, let's see who's next. Linda in Madison, it's your turn.
Okay, Larry, this is Linda, and I'm calling about property in Green Lake County, which has had a massive and increasing invasion of horsetail weed. And I know it spreads by root and by spores, and I don't know what to do. It's becoming a monoculture. So I'm hoping that there is something short of a 10-year solution.
Horsetail is
really hard because it's not a regular plant. It's not a regular vascular plant. And there hasn't been very much research done on it or many herbicides that really have been tested on it. People have tried various things on it, and I can't remember off the top of my head what has been successful. I know there have been a few things that people have found, but it is it's a tough one because it's not common enough of a problem that chemical companies are doing research on it. So I would think that maybe contacting a chemical rep that has been working on some of this might be good. We have a person that a lot of people in Wisconsin contact that does a lot of research on chemicals, and we could maybe put his name and number on the website or on your Facebook page. Is that how you do it, Larry?
Hopefully we can figure out a way to do that. Okay.
Yeah, so maybe check that later, Linda, and we'll see if we can get something for you.
Anne, thanks very much for calling. Visiting right now with Kelly Kearns, Invasive Plant Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR, and Anne Pierce, UW Extension Invasive Species Outreach Specialist. She's the program coordinator for the Wisconsin First Detector Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Sarah Hopeful, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. On the Ideas Network, we are taking a look at invasive species. This is Invasive Species Action Month. And Kelly Kearns, Ann Pierce with us today. Kelly with the Department of Natural Resources and with UW Extension Invasive Species Outreach Coordinator. So great to have both of them along. And there's one or two open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234. So give a call with your questions and comments. And, you know, we were talking about information and how to get information. Ann Pierce, there's some pretty good information out there that people can get online, if I'm not mistaken.
So one of the great resources that we have available through the UW Extension Learning Store is a series of invasive plant fact sheets. And these fact sheets cover somewhere around 50 invasive plant species. They include identification information, but more importantly, for those of you who are battling these plants on your properties, they include detailed management recommendations. So whether you prefer to avoid herbicides or you are trying to use herbicides and you're not sure what herbicides to use or what method, these are great resources to read in detail recommendations that have been researched through trials out in the field.
And if you just type in UW Extension Learning Store, I know it from experience, it pops right up.
Right. And then you can search for invasive species once you get to the Learning Store.
There we go. Let's go back to the phones for a minute here. Karen in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Yes. Hello. Good morning. My name is Karen, as you said, and I do gardening and property management in the southeastern Wisconsin area. And my comment is regarding control of garlic mustard. I believe this is the recommended protocol by University of Minnesota. And what we've been doing when large patches of garlic mustard is, you know, doing all the recommended spraying as your guest recommended earlier. But if we can't get to all that in a timely manner, once the plant is up and flowering, we go through with a weed whacker and we chop it down stage by stage. Like, so if you've got a, say, you know, an 18-inch plant, you know, we try to cut it down and like 3 to 4 inch weed whack it down all the way down to the bottom, but in pieces like that, and let it lay. The problem, as most people know with garlic mustard, is once you, if you pull the whole plant and let it lay, that seed is still viable because there's enough energy in the stem of the plant to still produce that seed and make some of it viable. We found that pulling on a regular basis, especially in a woodland area, brings dormant seed, not just garlic mustard, but all kinds of dormant seed to the surface, which then in turn germinates. Over the last two seasons, we've done this chopping down technique and have virtually eradicated garlic mustard in those areas, even with you know, just allowing the old foliage to lay there, including some of the seed pods. Does that sound, has anybody else had that? Have you had that experience yourself?
Kelly Kearns is...
Sure. Yeah, people have recommended that. One of the things that sometimes does happen is that you'll get resprouting of that garlic mustard. It has little dormant buds at the base of the plant, and they may resprout again. And there has been some recent research that just came out that that even though those plants resprout, send up new flowers, and can produce new seed pods, the very low percentage of those are actually viable seeds. And so that is good news that that those later stems that kind of resprout that come back from that tend to not produce a lot of seed. And so, yeah, I think the idea that you're using using the weed whip to chop up those plants, that does help prevent those seeds those seed pods that you've already cut down from really maturing and developing into viable seed. Yeah. So yeah, that's probably a pretty good technique. Best if you can go back and just check them again later, you know, a couple weeks later, because you probably will have missed some.
Yeah, makes sense. Thanks, Karen, for that. I appreciate it very much. Louise in Dodgeville, you're up. What's on your mind?
Hi, I have a question. We live on the border of Governor Dodge State Park out in Dodgeville. And we are new beekeepers, so we are trying to do a lot of prairie restoration and get a lot of native flowers going for the bees.
Sure.
So we noticed this kind of tall, spindly, pale, kind of purpley-blue flower growing, and we're like, oh, let's just let this grow. But I think it's bellflower or European bellflower, and I think I looked it up, and that it was an invasive. So it's not phlox, and what I read about it was that it kind of takes over a lot of stuff, but trying to balance out the needs of the bees with, you know, trying to get rid of invasives. So I guess
leave it, let it grow, took it out.
Yeah, what would you do, Kelly?
Well, has this plant already flowered?
It has.
Okay, then it's probably not bellflower. Bellflower tends to bloom later in the season. So does it look like phlox but has four petals instead of five?
No. It's really tall and skinny and kind of has more elongated leaves, and the flowers are kind of growing up along it, the height of it. And, yeah, they're just pale purple and small.
Well, I think you're stumping us.
You might take a photo of it and post it up on our Facebook page.
Yeah, that would be great. One of the other things that you can do, that anybody can do if you have a plant that you haven't been able to identify, is that you can, in addition to some of the resources that Ann will give us, you can send it to invasive.species@wisconsin.gov, and we'll help you identify it and then give you some control recommendations. If it were European bellflower, which is a very invasive plant, very common in urban areas especially, it has an incredible root system, and hand pulling alone tends to not do it. You have to repeatedly do that year after year, several times a year. But it is one that you don't want to let it go to seed, and you do want to keep after it. And a lot of people will use a systemic herbicide to go down and kill the root system.
There we go. Louise, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. And on to Ron in Norwalk. Ron, hi.
Hi. Good morning, Larry, and good morning to your guests. I'm a township official, and I just want to make a couple comments. But first, I want to give a shout-out to Ann Pierce. She came up to Monroe County. I'm from Ridgeville Township. She came up to Monroe County and did a program on invasives to all the rural patrolmen in the townships of Ridgeville, and she did really a nice job. So hopefully we can get some inroads on these. But basically, I think we've done more harm than good sometimes when it comes to mowing our road ditches. That seems to be a corridor that we probably spread more invasives than we've actually taken care of. So one of the things that Ann taught us is the timing of attacking some of these invasives, and I think that's really important. So I would encourage other township or other county officials, if they haven't been through the program, is to get, I guess, more information on invasives, and I think we can probably help control or at least reduce the spread of those. And also, I don't know if I come to the program late, if you talked about the application of mapping, but it's something that's really easy to use, and Ann showed us how to do that as well. And if anybody's interested in that, I'm sure you guys will be talking about it if you haven't already. So.
Yeah. Well, Ron, thanks so much for calling. Ann, talk about that program.
Sure. Thanks, Ron. Good to hear from you. So the mapping application that Ron was just talking about is the Great Lakes Early Detection Network app. And this was developed by some folks that run a national invasive species database called EdMaps. And basically, this tool allows you to map and report invasive species very easily using your smartphone or tablet. And so the program in Monroe County that Ron mentioned included training on how to use that app. And so for highway departments or park systems, this is a really easy tool for volunteers and professionals alike to use to get those invasive species infestations on a map. And at that point, you can use that information to start planning your management.
And how do you take requests? If county road crews or whatever contact you, are you willing to go out and speak?
Yeah, absolutely. That's part of my job as the coordinator of the First Detector Network. So if anybody, whether you're in a volunteer group or working with a highway department or parks department, I'm happy to talk with folks about getting some workshops put together so we can help people learn more about invasive species and learn how to use some of these reporting tools.
Yeah. And how do they get a hold of you?
The easiest way to get a hold of me is to email me. Mm-hmm. And my email address is ann.pierce@wisc.edu.
And Pierce is spelled P-E-A-R-C-E?
Correct. And so it's Anne with an E.
Oh, that's right. Anne with an A-N-N-E. P-E-A-R-C-E. And then what's the rest of it?
So it's Anne.Pierce at WISC.edu.
All right. There we go. And Ron, thanks for bringing this up. I really appreciate it. Let's turn to Maggie in Edgerton next. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, I'm calling. I wonder if maybe my problem sounds like the Louise who called before, but I bought a house 2 years ago and it had some really nice plantings, hydrangea and hostas and ferns. And but then a little plant started coming up and I didn't do anything the first year because I wanted to see what happened. And it took over everything and everything. It overshadowed everything except the hydrangeas and it's everywhere in every bed. And I tried pulling it up and my neighbor came out and said, oh, the owner before was doing that every year all the time and it always came back and she tried everything. And my mom thinks she found what it was. She said it was ground elder. And when I looked that up, it looked a lot like what they have in my yard for sure. It looked like the same flowers and leaves. And I have been unable, this year I've been digging out the roots. There are these little white roots that you have to sift out. But my problem is that I don't think I'm going to be able to do that with everything. And I want to save the ferns and hostas. So I wanted to know if there's any way I can kill the ground elder and save my ferns and hostas.
Trying to think of a ground elder doesn't ring a bell with me. Ground, it wasn't ground ivy, was it?
I don't know what ground ivy. It's not ivy. It doesn't grow like an ivy. It grows like an individual plant, and the flowers look a little bit like Queen Anne's lace. But the flower is, I mean, that like in terms of this white kind of lacy flower. But the leaves are totally different than that kind of plant. I don't know. She found it. She was watching a gardening show and they were talking about it. And then she sent me photos and I looked up the photos and I looked up and it has the same white roots and the same leaves and flowers. So I'm thinking that's what it is, but it's just like a weedy plant, but I don't know if there's any way to kill it without killing everything else, I guess.
Okay.
So Maggie, are the leaves solid green or are they variegated with some white on them?
Solid green.
Okay. So I just looked it up, too, because I've never heard that common name. But that's the problem with common names is that nobody uses the same names. And it shows that something that we typically call goutweed, it has that same name as well. And goutweed is really common. It is frequently, it was planted decades ago in people's yards. And it persists really, really well and takes over your beds. And it's another one of these plants that has these umbel-shaped white flowers. The good thing about it is it tends to spread just by the roots and not a lot by seed. And so, but you really have to kill all the roots. And so you can either, if it's just scattered in your bed, hand-pulling repeatedly is something you can do. If it's mixed in your bed, but it's so abundant you can't hand-pull it, one of the techniques you might want to use is to use the glove of death, where you take a good rubber glove, put that on your hand, and then put a cheap cloth glove over that. Spray an herbicide like glyphosate that is something that will kill a broadleaf plant. Spray that on your glove and then swipe the plants you want to kill. And that way you can very selectively just go after the plants you want to kill and not get that on the plants that are surrounding it like your ferns. But it's going to take repeated control like that over several years in order to get it under control. Lots of people have to deal with this plant, and it's a challenge, yeah. Mostly in urban areas.
All right. There we go. Thanks, Maggie. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Mark in Mequon, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
My call is about buckthorn, which is the scourge, of course, of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I have about an acre of woods, and it is just infested. And I have been battling the buckthorn in there for about 20 years. And last year I was not able. I usually cut it, and I've been spraying it, and it just comes back. And this last year it came back with a vengeance. And my question is, I'm looking at having one of those companies come in with those giant mowers, and they specialize in removing buckthorn. And I'm just wondering what your guest's experience with that is, and is it successful?
Well, sure. A lot of people have had folks like that come in, and if you have a really heavily infested site, then it can be a really good way to go. You're going to want to mark any of the trees that you want to protect, and you know, mark them well with a bright flagging tape so they can see that, and they should be able to avoid those trees. But it's got to be dense enough that you can actually get a bush hog essentially in there to do that control work. And that's not going to complete it because, of course, you're going to have resprouts coming up in some places, and you're going to have seedlings. So there's going to need to be follow-up work regardless of how you do it. But if you can burn through the area, if you're in an area where fire is an option, especially if it's in oak woods, then that's a really good way to get the buckthorn knocked back initially, and then you can keep controlling it with fire.
Yeah. Do goats work?
Goats are pretty effective in knocking it down, buckthorn down initially. But again, you need to have them come back repeatedly or follow up with other control methods. Goats are really great about just kind of masticating the stem, which is the same thing that the bush hog does. And so that's why it doesn't resprout as much as when you just would go through and cut it by itself. When you cut it, you get a nice clean cut, and that allows it to resprout well. When a goat or a bush hog goes through and rips it up, it's harder for that plant to resprout.
Yeah. There you go, Mark. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Mike and Liberty, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I don't know if you have heard of this, but I pasture hogs and been doing it for a number of years. And I've seen situations on the parcels I've pastured is areas that have been just thick of Canadian thistle, and after I've run my pigs through there, what comes back is just other plant life, not the thistle. And I've also seen that with wild parsnip. And so I was also liking to experiment with trying to find a parcel of wild garlic mustard that I could run my pigs in and see if we can't get the same kind of result. Your thoughts?
All right, so we just talked about goats, and now we've got pigs in the picture. What do you think?
Yeah, I haven't heard of people using pigs intentionally for this because pigs cause a lot of disturbance. You know, they root things up. They really cause much more disturbance of the soil than goats do. And so most people don't do that because if you have a fairly nice site that has some good species left in it, you may lose those good species as well. So if it's a really disturbed pasture kind of situation or old field situation that doesn't have anything you really care about, it's worth trying, I suppose.
Sure, why not?
I mean, most of us don't have that option to bring pigs into our property, but we definitely don't have any pig grazers that that lease out their pigs for hire in Wisconsin, as far as I know. We do have a few goat grazers that do, but definitely don't know anybody who does it with pigs. So
worth
let us
a
know,
shot.
Mike.
Yeah, worth a shot. Let us know, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. And Adam in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Adam.
Hi. We recently purchased the property along the Wisconsin River north of Wausau and noticed that the previous owner had kind of treated the area along the riverbank as sort of a waste disposal for yard waste, and it was pretty disturbed. He cut a lot of trees before we purchased it, and then what came back was actually a lot of poison ivy. And because of its proximity to the river there, we're kind of wondering what the best way to control this would be, since we do walk through there and try to get down to the pier without touching it.
Sure. So there's a number of chemicals that are used specifically for woody species, which poison ivy is. And the one that most people use is called triclopyr. The one that is most commonly known is Garlon. But triclopyr is the active ingredient. And I believe that it can be used near water, but not right on water. You would have to check the label on that. And there's a couple different kinds of triclopyr. And so you would want to check that and see if that's something that's a possibility. And just as you spray, make sure you're not getting it into the water itself. And, you know, maybe catch it early in the year before the leaves are really dense, so you can spray as little as possible.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling, Adam. Appreciate your call. And Alicia in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Alicia.
Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
I am calling about an invasive plant that I believe is called Avens. And I was telling Jill, wood Avens, A-V-E-N-S. And it's an open, scraggly plant about 18 inches tall with tough stems and sturdy roots with a profusion of seeds, making this plant a persistent garden weed if it gets a look in. Spreads through dappled woods. And I have been fighting this. And I live in an apartment building, so it really is a communal thing. You know, if nobody else is doing anything, those seeds blow. And it's killed everything, including dandelions, forget-me-nots. And I see it everywhere. And I just wondered if you all are familiar with this nasty little beast.
Sure. This plant is typically called wood avens. There's a whole group of plants that are the avens. This one is a fairly common weedy species, and especially like on the edges of woods and in really disturbed woods areas. So, like a lot of these herbaceous, weedy plants, you can either continue to hand pull, you can use hand pulling with weed whipping, like the caller talked about earlier, or if you feel that that's not getting to it, then you can do careful application of an herbicide such as glyphosate, or which is what Roundup is, or triclopyr, which is what Garlon is, and just being really careful what you spray. But this is, like many of the weedy plants, it's a biennial. And so the first year it will germinate, create a rosette, that rosette overwinters green, and then the next year it sends up that flowering stalk. And so you don't want to let it go to seed. That's the primary way that it's spreading. And so if you're going to be doing any control, make sure you do it before it has that little ball of seeds that are developing on it.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kelly Kearns, one of our guests today, invasive plant coordinator with the Wisconsin DNR, and Ann Pierce, UW Extension Invasive Species Outreach Specialist. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, talking invasive species today that are terrible things across the state of Wisconsin and elsewhere as well, with our two guests, Kelly Kearns from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Ann Pierce with UW Extension. She's the Invasive Species Outreach Specialist. So great to have both of them here. And join in. Questions, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Vernon O'Clair called to say he used rock salt around hard-to-kill plants like buckthorn and poison ivy. He says it's taken him about 4 years, but it kills him eventually. But rock salt is not something you recommend, is it?
Yeah. Well, it's not real great for the soil, to
right.
add a lot of salt to the soil. It probably will make it really difficult for much of anything to grow there, except for things that are really that are used to growing in a salty environment, things that aren't native here because we don't have a salty coastal environment. So it would be a tough one to replant with afterwards. You know, there are probably a few things that could survive, but not much. I do want to go back to the horsetail question that someone asked earlier, and it turns out there's an old extension publication from UW Extension from a number of years ago about controlling it in croplands, but it also mentions in non-crop areas, and it says that there's only two herbicides that are recommended for it, and one is called Casiron. And another is called Teller or Oust. So those three are a possibility in those areas. So if Louise wants to get a hold of me through the invasive.species@wisconsin.gov email, then she can do that, and I can pass that on to her.
All right. Well, excellent. Let's move to another caller, Michael in Adams Friendship. Your turn. Hi, Michael.
Thank you guys for taking my call. Yeah, I've had success, just pulling the invasives out. North side is really wooded, and I had a huge patch of garlic mustard, and I really liked the wood violets, and so I just, you know, spent a couple of hours out there weeding out those invasives, and next spring it was a huge patch of purple out there, and so it really worked. And then I had Queen Anne's lace on the south side, more sunny, and I did the same thing. And then I had more Rudbeckia and other natives once I did that. My question is, what about, you know, something as big like this? There's many-tier approach, so why not eat the invasives that are edible?
Well, I do eat a lot of edible invasives, and unfortunately, there's only so many you can eat. Yeah. I mean, I could easily make a lot of pesto from just like one park's worth of garlic mustard and not get all the garlic mm-hmm. mustard out of it. So it is, there's a lot more out there than we can use. Yeah. If a lot of people ate these, then that would be fine. But for the most part, there's more than we can possibly use.
Which ones do you use? So garlic mustard, you could?
Oh, garlic mustard, you know, makes great pesto, and you know, can use it in cooking of any sorts. I use lamb's quarters a lot, too, late in the season, because they're available all year long. The things like Queen Anne's lace and burdock, those, if you're going to harvest those and parsnip, you want to get them at the end of their first year in the fall, winter, or the beginning of the second year, yeah. or really early in the spring. You're digging up those roots, and you got to get them when they're not actively growing.
Claire emailed to say there's a lovely marsh in the lake behind Edgewood College that's in Madison along Park and Pleasure Drive. Over the past few years, a few invasive trees started popping up in the marsh. This year, the trees are about to take over. What are those trees that can grow in a cattail marsh, and how do you manage them? Unfortunately, we don't have a photo or a description of the trees. Would buckthorn, you know, it's not a tree, but would it look like a tree?
Yeah, common buckthorn could possibly do that. Glossy buckthorn tends to do better in wetter areas like that. The native box elder is really good at growing in those yeah. disturbed wet areas. And, of course, native willows, that is their native habitat. So there's a number of things it could be. If she might want to send in some photos.
Yeah, if we send some photos in, we'll take a look and see what we can come up with. But you're right, there are some that are not invasive that are actually out there and would maybe thrive in those areas. Emily in Madison, your turn. Hi, Emily.
Hi, I'm wondering about Virginia creeper. I've had it, I've seen it around, and my whole family started to become very allergic to it. And it's all over our yard now. I'm wondering what we can do.
Virginia creeper. I didn't know people could be allergic to Virginia creeper. Is there something else that might look like Virginia creeper that could be causing it?
Yeah, can you describe the plant?
Oh, yeah. It's a. I've looked it up and everything. So it's a five leaf. It has little, you know, rugged edges, ground sprawl.
Is it a vine? A woody vine?
It's a vine. Yep.
Okay.
Woody vine.
Okay.
Yep.
I've never heard of anybody being allergic to Virginia creeper either. Basically, because that stuff has a vine that lays down roots everywhere it touches the soil, you just have to keep yanking it up and pulling every single root up that you can every time. And that's what I do in my yard, and I still have it. But that's really the best way to do it. As it's climbing trees, then you can easily cut the base of the tree, and you can apply an herbicide to that cut stump. But you just aren't going to be able to get enough leaf matter to kill all the stems, probably, if it's growing on the ground and mixed in with other plants. So it's really a matter of hand-pulling. Or in your case, if everybody's allergic, maybe hire somebody to come in and do it for you.
Yeah, that might be the best approach if everybody's allergic to it. I hadn't heard of that before, so... Sorry, Emily. Probably a lot of pulling in your future, but appreciate your call. Tom in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry and guest. I doubt if anybody will agree with me. This is an opinion. I know about all the invasives, but I'm hearing about things like woodland almonds, and now somebody's mentioning Virginia creeper again, which is not an invasive exotic plant, but one of our natives. It can be trouble when it's not where you want it, but my opinion is that every ounce of effort and every dollar of expense should be geared towards two or perhaps three of our invasives, and we would do by far the most good. Those three are garlic mustard, common buckthorn, and I have to add phragmites in the emerging zone. If only all our efforts would be spent on those, we would be doing so much more good than worrying about all this other nonsense.
Okay, well, what do you think, Kelly?
Well, it's really, you know, it depends on what you've got. If Emily has Virginia creeper and it's causing problems in her yard, she needs a control of Virginia creeper, and she doesn't have garlic mustard. We actually tend to push, instead of really focusing on those really widespread things like buckthorn and garlic mustard, instead catching the things that are just starting to spread instead. We have a lot of species that are regulated as prohibited plants in Wisconsin because they're not here yet, or because they're only in a few areas, and like that wild chervil that I mentioned earlier, if you can catch that before it starts to spread, before it goes to seed, you can keep it from spreading all over. And the same with that poison hemlock. We don't have kudzu in Wisconsin yet, as far as we know, but it's in northeast Illinois and Ontario. It could very well be here. As soon as somebody finds it, as long as we can keep it under control, then we can prevent it from spreading. And so it's really those ones that you can catch early on, put just a little bit of effort into keeping them controlled, that are really the ones you can get the best bang for the buck. You know, right now, probably garlic mustard is probably in thousands and thousands and thousands of people's yards and woodlands, and we are not going to get every single one of those people to control it on their properties. It's just not going to happen. And the same with buckthorn, and the birds are going to spread the buckthorn around. People who can control it and really want to control it, that's great, but it's not going to happen statewide.
Yeah, unfortunately. Diana in Caledonia, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi there, thanks for taking my call. I would like to ask whether any attention is being given to a newcomer to Wisconsin. I first saw it in Ohio, and its name is Teasel, T-E-A-S-E-L.
Right.
It is a terrible, noxious plant. It's taking over the roadsides along our freeways. It's spreading northward. It is the absolute worst plant to handle. It's thornier than a thistle, and it doesn't even have a flower that is attractive, you know, to make somebody say, well, I kind of like that, you know, I like the way that looks, I'm going to leave it. Teasel is just it's like an outlaw that's arrived in Wisconsin, and I've traveled west and I've traveled north, and I've seen it progressing. And
well, let's teasel. Can we teasel that out a little bit,
sure,
Kelly?
So, unfortunately, teasel is not brand new to all of Wisconsin. It's been in parts of the state for quite a while, especially up in the Fox Valley and down in the southeast parts of Madison. But it is just starting to spread in some areas. A lot of people are familiar with this plant. It's super easy to identify. It's on roadsides usually. Has a very stiff stem with what looks like a brush on the top, kind of an oval brush of spiky seed heads. And there's actually two species. One has purple flowers and one has white flowers. And as soon as those seeds develop, then they drop just right around where the plants are. And so you have a population that starts to expand gradually from those seeds dropping near the plant. And so it's actually not one of our worst ones as far as spreading rapidly, because it tends to stay fairly local and just spread gradually. And it's fairly easy to control if you get in there and mow it before it goes to seed. Or you can do an herbicide application of on the basal plants. Unfortunately, oftentimes mowing happens, especially on roadsides, after it's gone to seed, and then it gets spread that way, which is oftentimes how it gets moved up and down those roadsides, and it moves into other people's places. So it certainly is something that there's plenty of herbicides that work on it. You can cut the stem, take a shovel and cut it down. So lots of different things that can be done to control that. But it is one that, in some areas, it is one of those early detection plants. And when the first plant gets in, if you don't let it go to seed, you have really done a good job of keeping it from spreading.
Someone emailed and wondered if barberry and tansies are invasive species. She brought them in a few years ago and now can't get rid of them.
Yeah, unfortunately, there are some. There's two species of barberry. There's a common barberry that actually has the barberry wheat rust is the alternate host for the wheat rust, and that's pretty well been wiped out through most of the state. There are some still pockets of it still around, but Japanese barberry is the other one that's really common in landscaping, and some of them unfortunately do spread by seed and can be quite invasive. And tansy is especially a problem up in the northern part of the state, and it spreads vegetatively.
So, we have lots to talk about yet, as a matter of fact, with our guest today. Kelly Kearns with us, invasive plant coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Ann Pierce, UW Extension Invasive Species Outreach Specialist and Program Coordinator for the Wisconsin First Detector Network. Kelly's going to stay with us. Ann, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
And coming up after our news break, Nels Jorgensen will join Kelly. Nels, a PhD student with the UW-Madison Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. He'll be talking about how invasive information is used, what the research is being used for. And tell you what, I thank you for listening, but please stay with us. We'll be here until 12:30 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. June is Invasive Species Action Month, and we're talking about what you can do to control invasives. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kelly Kearns, Invasive Plant Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR, and joined now by Nels Jorgensen, PhD student with the UW-Madison Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. And Nels, I welcome you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question about invasives, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Pat in Woodstock, Illinois. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We are fighting a losing battle with crown vetch. Any suggestions?
What's your situation? You have it in a grassland area?
Yes, yeah. We're trying to establish a prairie in front, and I believe it came from our neighbors. She had some planted on her embankment, and I just can't seem. I keep pulling it, and I just can't seem to keep up with it.
Okay, so crown vetch is a legume, and a lot of the legumes have seeds that persist for many, many, many years, and so you will likely keep getting seedlings popping up over the years, and we'll have to keep going after those. But it also has a pretty persistent root system, and so one of the things that you might want to consider doing, since it sounds like it's mixed in with some of your other plants, is using that glove of death method again of putting the herbicide on your glove and actually swiping the individual plants, unless there's enough of it that you can actually spot spray those plants. And there's actually several chemicals that are pretty effective on crown vetch. There's one called Transline, which is specifically good for legumes, and composites, which is the sunflower family. And that one is fairly specific, and so it wouldn't kill your grasses. Another thing that would work is the Habitat. That one does kill some of the grasses, so you'd want to be careful with that. And then Escort is, which is metsulfuron, and Milestone, which is aminopyrrolidone. They're all things that are pretty good against crown vetch, but again, you're going to have to just keep going after it repeatedly, and just be really careful that you are targeting just that and not letting it get on the other plants that the herbicide might affect. So whichever herbicide you choose to use, read the label, find out what it actually kills, and be super careful if those plants are nearby.
Thanks very much for calling, Pat. Appreciate your call. You know, earlier in the show, Ann Pierce talked with us about the Wisconsin First Detector Network, and Nels Jorgensen has been working with data that has been collected by citizen scientists. And Nels, talk about that a little bit. How do you why do you gather the information, and how is it used?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons that we should be collecting this data. One is for general land managers. They might want to know exactly where some of these species are on their landscape and how that's spreading over time. And now we can display all these things on a map. But what we can also do is we can take some of these occurrence records and predict what the potential distribution of suitable habitat could be for these species across the state of Wisconsin.
So you can take a look at where they're growing, and then you look at the soil type or the growing conditions of a particular area?
That's right. You could look at topographic elements such as slope and aspect. You could look at distance to roads. I know that's a really good predictor of where habitat could be for an invasive plant, especially here in Wisconsin, among a variety of other potential predictors of habitat.
Are there some trends that are poking up that you're seeing in the research that you're doing?
Well, we know that there are some species that we have a lot of really good reports for in the southern part of the state, but that we're predicting suitable habitat for in the northern parts of the state and vice versa. And so what we've done is we've tried to summarize some of that information into useful online tools that we've actually put on the Wisconsin First Detector Network webpage that anyone can access.
I'm wondering about climate change and how, if there's an impact or if it's affecting invasive species.
Yeah, so what we are seeing, and there's been a lot of really good work across the country, and I'm specifically just focused on Wisconsin, but what we are finding is that there's a general shift northwards in Wisconsin. We've done some modeling work with Phragmites, Japanese hedge parsley, and some others, and there's more to come on that. We're still in the early stages of development of those models, but certainly we are seeing a shift in potential distribution of some of these species.
Are there some new ones that we're seeing? What are some of the latest invasions that we have?
Well, so there are some species that we just really don't have a lot of good reports for.
Okay.
And so we've built some of these online tools for our citizen scientists or our land managers that they can access. And so we're looking at species like Japanese barberry, which we don't have a lot of reports for, but that we are finding in our forest systems right now. Wild chervil, which Kelly brought up a little bit earlier, we're seeing it in pockets in the north, but we really don't have reports for it down here in the southern part of the state. A couple others are autumn olive, as well as garden valerian and European marsh thistle, also found in the northern part of the state.
You're giving me too long a list. This is terrible that we're having all these new ones coming in.
I know. And so what I'd like to do is just make sure that people are going to our resource and using that as a jumping off point for getting involved with reporting invasive species in Wisconsin.
And where do they go again? Let's repeat that.
Yep. You're going to go to the WIFTN webpage, which was brought up earlier in the program, and then you're going to follow the links to the ESRI story map.
And what's the site again? Do you have the specific site?
It's fyi.uwex.edu/WIFDN.
WIFDN. Okay, there we go. Well, we've got callers online, so we should probably take some more calls here. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Christy in Potosi, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
I don't know if black swallowwort is on your radar, but I can tell you that in southern Grant County, it is, terrible. So I don't know what you know about this plant. I have two fact sheets. One is from the Michigan DNR, published in 2007, and the one I have from UW Extension is published in 2012. So we're undertaking a program. We know it's a multi-year program to try to bring it under control on our property. So one of my questions is, do you have anything to add? And is there anything more recent than these 2007 and 2012 fact sheets?
Yeah, good question. So unfortunately, you happen to be in the hub of black swallowwort. This is a plant that's in the milkweed family, and it's actually a vine with very shiny leaves. And for some reason, somebody brought it into Potosi back in the 40s. And we've got herbarium vouchers from the 1940s in Potosi. And that's so as far as we know, that's the first place in the state that it was found. And it is all over in Southwest Grant County. And so unfortunately, Christy just happens to have her land in the middle of this. And so there's a number of people that have been doing work on it in that area. You have a contractor that works in your area that has done a fair amount of work on it, and he probably would be a really good person to talk to. It's Driftless Land Stewards, and I would definitely recommend contacting them. They probably have done the most work on it recently, and since you already have the fact sheets that UW Extension has, you know what the herbicides are that are effective. But one of the things that I would especially make sure you're doing is using a surfactant in your herbicide, because of those really shiny leaves, they're very waxy, and so it's hard for the herbicide to get into that leaf without having some kind of a surfactant in that herbicide.
And does that typically come with in the herbicide? You need to look and...
No, you need to add it.
You need to add it.
Yeah,
okay.
And so you can either buy a surfactant specifically at the store where you get your chemical, or you can use, there's various soap kind of products that can be used for that.
Okay.
And so I would definitely look more detail about what, depending on which chemical you're using, which surfactant is the best one to use for that.
All right. Christy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Leslie in Fitchburg, it's your turn. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call.
I have a question about buckthorn trees. Are there different species of buckthorn trees that are actually okay for nurseries to sell? I had a popular nursery close to me that received a box of 15 trees while I was standing there, and I questioned the owner, and he said, oh, yeah, buckthorns get a bad name. These are okay.
Well, there are a couple of native buckthorns. I've never heard of them being for sale. They're very uncommon and not very showy, so I don't think it would be those. The common buckthorn, which is the one most people complain about and have problems with, that one does not have any cultivars that are available for sale. So that one should definitely not be for sale anywhere. And I can't imagine people even wanting to buy it. It's not a lovely plant in any way. However, the glossy buckthorn, which is a frangipani, ulnus, that plant does have multiple cultivars, and there is one cultivar, the fine line, that has not been regulated yet, because we don't have any evidence that that one specifically is causing the damage. And so in a number of these species where we have evidence of one particular cultivar is a problem, but we don't know if the other cultivars are, generally we've exempted those other cultivars if it's something that's important to the nursery industry. Not many people are selling glossy buckthorn anyway, even those exempt cultivars. So it kind of surprises me that nursery is selling it. Mm-hmm. We do have, our Department of Agriculture does inspect every licensed nursery in the state, and they are always looking for the regulated invasive plants while they're out there. And so if they see something that is being sold that should not be, they will tell the nursery about that, and they will have them get rid of it.
There we go. So Leslie should probably take a look, maybe a closer look, is to see what that buckthorn.
Yeah, and if you do get the name of the plant or the cultivar, and it is one of the ones that's regulated, then definitely let us know. Again, contact us at invasive.species@wisconsin.gov.
Thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Couple of things. Judy called to say the garlic mustard on her property is being pushed out by globe flower. Could this be an option for controlling mustard? I'm trying to think what globe flower looks like, but I'm not coming. It's not hitting my brain right at the moment.
Yeah, there's a number of species that have globe in the common name, but
yeah.
I'm not real sure what one she specifically is talking about. But anything that grows really densely in a shaded area could potentially do that. But the problem is most plants don't grow really densely in that area. Yeah, there is something called Trolleus that it's in the buttercup family.
So a kind of a yellow flower?
Yeah, bright yellow flower. A number of the buttercups can be somewhat aggressive as well. And I don't know about this Trolleus specifically, but I would be cautious about replacing garlic mustard with something else that might be extremely aggressive.
Dave emailed to remind us that horsetail is an ancient native plant and we should celebrate its history and maybe not use chemicals to get rid of it.
Yeah, unless it happens to be in an area where you really want something else to be growing. And you know, it really depends on the site. You know, certainly in you know our parks and our state natural areas, we would let it keep growing. There's no reason to get rid of it there. But if a particular landowner really doesn't want it growing in a particular area, that is their prerogative to try to control it.
It's kind of how we define a weed, isn't it? It's growing a plant that's growing somewhere where you don't want it.
Exactly, right.
Yeah. John in Stevenson, Michigan, it's your turn. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, sure. Hey, listen, you guys are talking about the crown veg and the autumn olive. That's excellent honey and nectar source for honeybees. If you can't be spraying them off now, you'll be killing the honeybees and all the other pollinators that use it. Plus, those plants are excellent cover for, like, wildlife and your partridges and things like that. So go easy on those crown veg and autumn olives. They're beautiful flowers and very beneficial to have around.
All right, John, thanks for calling. Kelly, comment?
Yeah, of course, our honeybees are not native either. Of course, they're not invasive. They're very helpful insects that we've introduced into the country. And most of the time when people are doing an herbicide application, it's not going to be when something's in flower. So, if you were controlling autumn olive, generally you're going to be doing that in the fall by cutting it down and then applying an herbicide to that cut stump. And generally you're not going to be doing like crown veg control when it's flowering. But there are lots of other things for those bees to eat, lots of native plants as well. And so I'm sure that they would find something else. But yeah, certainly you do want to take that into account if you do have a lot of bees in that area.
And John in Kenosha says that he uses cardboard to cover and get rid of garlic mustard. And, you know, if you got a small area and you want to use cardboard, I guess you could lay it down and
yeah, that's great.
Suffocate
you have a 10-acre parcel, that's a lot of cardboard.
Yeah, that's the only problem with that. Well, superweeds. We hear a bit about superweeds these days. Tell us about superweeds.
I'm not sure what plant you would be talking about necessarily.
Well, somebody was talking with me the other day about superweeds, and I was trying to... I was guessing that those are weeds that are practically impossible to kill.
It could be. It could also be things that are resistant to herbicides. For example, Palmer amaranth has started to spread a lot in the Midwest, and we don't have a lot of occurrences that we know of in Wisconsin, but it has developed resistance to three of the main chemicals that are used to kill the pigweed amaranth family. And so people in agriculture are pretty concerned about that plant.
Let's go to Kay in Prairie du Chien next. Hi, Kay.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Okay, I have, it's a vining plant. When it first starts out, it looks like maybe when the shoots first start coming out of the ground, they look like a watermelon or cucumber plant, and then they grow a long vine, and they keep reaching out, and they will grow up along fence lines. They'll climb up into the trees. I've seen them along fence rows on the highway, and they're horrible. They're hard to get rid of. And when they're dry out, they have a long needle. It's real fine, and they have short needles. And you go to pull them, and they'll go right through the glove.
Yeah, so do they have white flowers?
I believe so. I've been trying to keep them pulled now, so I really can't recall.
Yeah,
but
so
I've seen them along the highway along fence rows, and they're horrible.
Yeah, it's probably wild cucumber that you're talking
That's
about.
That's what I was thinking.
And wild cucumber spreads only by seed. And each of those individual fruits that looks like a very small cucumber or gourd will produce a couple of very large seeds. And so if you want to keep it from spreading, you just go out and collect up those fruits while they're still in fruit or cut it back where those fruits are, and it won't produce any more seeds. And they're very... weather dependent. In some years they are super aggressive and there's a lot of them, and other years there's hardly any. So it really depends on the individual season.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in too again, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or with your comments. Well, there's, you know, let's go back to the information that's out there, publications and so forth that are available for invasive plants. And Kelly, you should talk a little about the website that you've got with DNR relating to invasives.
Sure. The DNR website has all of our regulated plants are on there, and there's photos of each of them. There's a fact sheet for each that includes some control information, oftentimes linking back to the fact sheets that Ann mentioned earlier that are from UW Extension, because those are really the best fact sheets that we have locally. And then just further information as well, other resources that are out there for them. And lots of other information on there as well, as far as like how to report things, how to get connected with local volunteer groups, things like that.
And I know there's something invasive, what's it, invasive.species@wi.gov?
Correct. That's how you can contact us if you have some questions about a particular plant or want to report something, especially if it's something that you think is really new to the area and we should be knowing about it, then reporting it there. We don't need everybody to report all their populations of buckthorn and garlic mustard. That if you do want to report that, do that through the Great Lakes Early Detection Network app that Ann talked about, the Gledon app, and then that information can be used in these databases that Nels was talking about.
And Lee in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Lee. Lee, are you there? No, I guess we lost. I guess we lost Lee. So let's go to Marie in Green Bay. Hi, Marie.
Hi, how are you this afternoon?
Great, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
My question, my concern, I guess, would be, it seems like many people want to control their environment as opposed to letting things develop naturally, and we're talking about nature, so the fact that we're trying to control things, I guess, is a concern, especially since the guests didn't know what a superweed was, but that has so many different connotations to it. So I guess I wanted to get viewpoint on, is there a way to re-educate the public that nature has its own course, and instead of us trying to control it, we tend to find a way to work with it instead of poisoning everything?
All right, Kelly.
Sure. Well, I think that most people are trying to work with nature, and part of the problem is that these plants that are highly invasive are things that were brought in by humans, and they're displacing what our native plants would be and our natural ecosystems are, and they impact our natural ecosystems so that they can't perform the way that they would on their own. And oftentimes it's because there is some kind of human disturbance in the area, and that's why you want to be very targeted when you do any control like this, so that you're not impacting anything any more than necessary.
Good answer to that. Thanks again, Marie, for calling. Appreciate it. And Kelly and Nels, thank you so much for being with us. They really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Thanks for having us.
Kelly Kearns is the invasive plant coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Joining her today, Nels Jorgensen. Nels, a PhD student with the UW-Madison Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. Great to have them with us, and I'm sure they'll be back and we'll probably do this again, because I'm pretty sure that all the invasives are not going to go away anytime soon. Tomorrow at this time, home improvement specialist John Freiberger joins us. He'll be back to talk about how to do a masonry repair correctly and, of course, answer your home renovation questions. So I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, hey, thanks a lot for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.